Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Dr. Carl Bradley, extension plant pathologist with the University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How's Vicki today?
I'm doing well. It's a nice day today. The sun's shining, and I've got an extra guest with me today. So at Webster County High School here in Dixon, Kentucky, it is a job shadow day for the freshmen at Webster County High School. I don't know if that's the correct name now, but that's still what I call it. Okay. And so my niece is here with us today. So Miss Campbell Leggett is here. She's learning a little bit what it's like to be an ag agent. So we're glad to have her sitting in with us today.
Pretty good thing to do. We've all had an opportunity through the years to have students, whether they're high school students or college students, shadow us. Hopkins County, where I just transferred from, we've got one of the community college students shadowing in that office right now. And it's a chance for them maybe to learn. You know, I think there's maybe some overstatements about on-the-job skills you can learn by shadowing somebody, but if nothing else, it's an introduction to what that job is and what they do, and maybe just open your eyes to the possibilities that may be out there.
I agree. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, they don't let too many of them kids hang around me much.
I wonder why.
They use caution when it comes to David.
That's probably a good idea, and I'm okay with that.
I don't know. They might learn something you don't teach in school.
I expect they learn a whole lot they don't teach in school, I imagine.
But he did get very high praises about his work at the volunteer forum that he worked at a few weeks ago.
Mm. So it seemed like years.
Yeah, it was a long 2 years, actually. But anyway.
So tell us about some of those high praises. What did I have not heard this.
I let her read an email this morning, and now she's getting to gig me a little bit about it.
I'm not gigging you. It's a good thing. Dr. Ken Culp was sent him a nice email about how well he had done.
The authority himself.
And, yes, I told him it was pretty good. I think it was very good, David.
Well, I try to, when presented with a job, try to focus and do the best that I can. So.
Absolutely.
And that's pretty much what he said in there, that he did an amazing job. So.
Yep. We'll try not to dwell on that. I'm glad Carl's here.
change the subject much.
Yeah.
We do have an additional guest with us today. Not only do we have Vicki's niece, but Carl Bradley, how you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Glad to have you here with us this morning. It's a beautiful day in West Kentucky. It's a spring day. Temperatures are supposed to get up in the low 70s. We're recording this in March. It won't air until sometime in April, but a lot of things on the forefront of happening right now as far as production agriculture goes.
Yep.
It looks like an early spring. Now, I know it can change quickly, but it's sure looking like an early spring, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of anhydrous being put down. I saw that yesterday, and I just happened to get back from Oklahoma about a week or so ago, and coming across Missouri there, you know, they were working a lot of ground down through there. So they've already, I don't know what you call it, but I call it kind of just hipping up those where the cotton is grown across there, and they had done several fields like that. So, you know, it's, you know, Vicki, I don't know if early spring is good. But we're going to find out, and, you know, I've already heard about folks talking about planting soybeans, so, you know, it's a little different production, and maybe, Carl, you may even talk about that just a little bit. You know, this is a big change from what we used to do several years ago. We didn't plant any soybeans around here until May, that is completely different than what some folks are doing now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind of a change in thought about which crop to plant first. And there's a big push to plant soybeans first. And there's some disease considerations to think about. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit. But, I'm already aware. I'm from not too far from here, really, southeastern Illinois. That's where I'm originally from. And I know of somebody who has already planted soybeans.
Really?
In southeastern Illinois right now. So,
again, it's March.
You know,
and this was 2 weeks ago when they planted.
Well, I had heard that there was some planting
going on.
Like
a group two bean or what?
I think it was just trying out a planter. Okay. I don't think they planted a whole lot, but it was on Facebook that they had planted.
Yeah. Were they pulling it with a pontoon boat? Or?
Oh, probably man. Unseasonably dry this time of year, too, on top of we've had a fairly mild winter, I would think, here in western Kentucky for sure, and maybe across our kind of our region here. But, you know, there's been a lot of groundwork that normally does not get worked this early. Mm-hmm. And so we'll just have to kind of see how it goes. But, you know, as the spring progresses, you know, my grandmother used to say, you know, March is in like a lamb and out like a lion. So I don't know
one
way
or
the other. Yeah.
Compared to last year, it was in like a lion. Last year,
that's right.
We had those big winds on March the 3rd.
That's right.
This year, totally different start to the month.
Yeah. So we'll see how things go. But a completely different strategy than what we're probably used to. And Carl, talk a little bit about. We'll just get started. You know, we're talking about planting these soybeans this early. You know, what are some things from a disease standpoint, what are some things we need to be looking out for?
Sure. Yeah. Some of the first pathogens that a soybean is going to encounter are going to be in the soil. And, you know, one of the reasons that we didn't used to plant until May was because of sudden death syndrome. That was one of the main things. And we know that pathogen that causes that disease, it does pretty well in cool, wet soils. It's a fungus. It's called Fusarium virgiliforme. Is the name of the fungus that causes this disease. And it can start to infect soybean roots as soon as they germinate. So that radical, that young seedling root. And the earlier the infection occurs, the worse the disease is going to be. And mm-hmm. So that's definitely something to think about as farmers are thinking about planting earlier and earlier. That's a disease that's definitely going to be a higher risk when you're mm-hmm. planting earlier. So you got to look at your soybean varieties. You got to be sure that you're picking varieties that have a good level of resistance to sudden death syndrome. We have a couple of seed treatments that can help as well.
This I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, this is something that we didn't used to have. I guess Ilevo was registered about, I can't remember now, at least 10 years ago, I think. So that was kind of the first product that was on the market that had some mm-hmm. efficacy against sudden death syndrome. And then Saltro wasn't too far behind it as far as when it became available. And so we have both of those products right now. And they're not silver bullets. That's something I always tell farmers. If you have a susceptible variety and you've got conditions that are really favorable for SDS or sudden death mm-hmm. syndrome, it's not going to prevent it from occurring. It can slow down infection. It can kind of delay infection, but you might still have disease. So again, it's important to think about those resistant varieties first mm-hmm. and then maybe applying one of those seed treatments mm-hmm. to it as well. And that's going to give you a lot more protection with both of those together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. On the resistant varieties, is there several that are resistant or somewhat resistant, or is it limited?
There should be a lot, really. I mean, so this was a disease. So again, I'm from southeastern Illinois. So I was a kid when SDS first came into our farm, and that was in the 1980s. And I think it came into western Kentucky just maybe a little bit before mm-hmm. that. So, you know, soybean breeding companies have been working on this disease for a long period of time. There for a while at the beginning, nothing was resistant. Everything right. was susceptible. But over time, we've built up some good resistant varieties. Sometimes things can slip through the cracks a little bit, though, so we have to be careful with that, mm-hmm. especially if there's maybe like a new trait that's being released. And we see this oftentimes with some of the new herbicide-resistant traits. Mm-hmm. Once they kind of come into the market, maybe some of that first generation of soybean varieties that come on, they may not be completely vetted against all the diseases and such that might affect yield. And so sometimes it takes a little bit more breeding to kind of get those up to par. I think we're there now. Mm-hmm. We did see maybe a few things, you know, when Roundup Ready to yield beans mm-hmm. came out, and early, like 2011-ish, right around there, 2009 or 2011, I can't remember. We had a lot of SDS. I was still at Illinois at the time, working there. I wasn't yet in Kentucky, mm-hmm. but we had a lot of SDS kind of right around that timing. We had environment that was really conducive for it, but
right.
some of those varieties were a little bit more susceptible, and it just took some breeding to kind of get those mm-hmm. back up to par. So that's always something to look out for. But like I said, things can kind of escape. They can kind of make it to the marketplace that maybe wouldn't be the best bean to choose. So you really got to rely on those ratings. Talk to your seed dealer. Mm-hmm. In my mind, SDS should be one of the prime, you know, everybody's always worried about yield, of course. Yield's number one. But if you're really planting early, I think mm-hmm. you got to really look at SDS as one of those things that's going to be important to look at too in varieties. So absolutely. And another thing, I'll just go ahead and put a plug in for it now, because one of the things that we see related with SDS is soybean cyst nematode. Oftentimes where you've got SDS, maybe it's really bad, most likely you're going to have soybean cyst nematode problems in that field as well. Those two right. oftentimes are together, and SCN can make SDS worse. So over the last few years, and it's continuing through this spring, and hopefully beyond that, but definitely through this spring, the Kentucky Soybean Promotion Board is paying for sampling, paying for tests, soybean mm-hmm. cyst nematode tests. These tests are normally anywhere from $25 to $40 a piece, and if you're a Kentucky farmer, you can take advantage of that. And so you just need to go out and take some samples and bring them into your local county extension office, and those will get sent off, and it's a great way to kind of see what's going on in your field as well. Planting date doesn't have such a big of effect on soybean cyst nematode, but that's certainly something that's out there yep. that we need to watch out for.
But that is something, though, that, you know, when you're talking about yield, that is something that can hurt your yield, and you may not even really realize it. And so getting those samples is really important. And when somebody is willing to pay for those samples,
yeah.
I mean, those samples aren't free. They're just free to Kentucky producers.
Right.
And so, I mean, there is a cost to that. And we've got the Kentucky Soybean Promotion Board willing to put that bill. I think it is something that our producers really need to take advantage of. And it's not difficult to get those samples. It's taken much like a soil sample. And I even, you know, tell producers, just when you're out there getting soil samples, go ahead and get those mm-hmm. samples as well. So really encourage folks to do that, because it can give you some really good information and you might be surprised.
Well, I was going to, you know, ask Carl, you know, how important is having those cyst nematode counts from a management standpoint? How important is it to have those?
Well, like Vicki said, it's actually one of the biggest yield reducers that we have. It's for, as far as diseases, it's number one, not just in Kentucky, but in mm-hmm. the U.S. and Canada.
Yep.
So, you know, if you are getting sort of, if your yields have sort of plateaued over time, right? You're getting better yields, but then they just kind of plateau, and you just can't seem to break that threshold. It's probably soybean cyst nematode might be have something to do with it. We often, almost always, we don't see symptoms from it, mm-hmm. Unless it's a really, really dry year, mm-hmm. then you might see, you know, yellowing kind of occurring yeah. from it. But it causes yield loss without really noticing it. Just
I was gonna say, you can't even see it.
Yeah,
you know, yeah,
yeah. You notice it from, you know, how much grain your combine, your yield monitor.
Yeah,
you can see now. You can actually see the female cysts on the roots.
Right.
You kind of got to look closely. You can use your camera on your phone to kind of zoom in a little bit. But the best time to be looking for those is probably like in June or so, mm-hmm. when you got some root development there. Mm-hmm. You got to be real careful. You kind of need to dig them up and kind of wash them off. You don't really want to pull them out of the ground, because you'll be knocking those cysts off. But that's one way you can look for them with your own naked eyes. But
yeah, you can see them pretty good too if you kind of yeah. get it dug up and kind of get the dirt knocked off of it a little yeah. bit. But yeah, you can really see it really good.
Yeah, but take those samples. That's the yeah. best way to really know.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Talk a little bit about crop rotation and what that means to helping bust up that cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we plant with like a non-host crop like corn, mm-hmm. We can see up to about a 50% reduction of the soybean cyst nematode eggs in the soil. Now, you don't see, so if you decided, well, I'm just going to keep doing that, I'm going to keep planting corn and really reduce that, the biggest effect is from year one of that rotational crop. And then you see, you know, still some reduction on year two and maybe a little bit of reduction in year three of a non-host crop, but it starts to level off. So, so really, you know, not planting continuous soybean, that's something that could certainly drive up those SCN populations. Be sure that you have at least 1 year of corn in there. That's going to kind of help keep those down. The other thing that we see, actually, some work my predecessor, Dr. Don Hirschman, here at the University of Kentucky had done back in the 1990s, was looking at the effect of wheat residue, and had found that where you've got wheat residue in that field, for whatever reason, we don't really know the reason why, but it can kind of reduce or limit the reproduction of the soybean cyst nematode. So I think that's one of the things that's kind of benefited Kentucky farmers, because wheat, you know, not everywhere, but in a lot of locations, wheat is a very important rotational crop, and it can really help with soybean cyst nematode levels. This work was basically kind of repeated just a few years ago by some researchers at Southern Illinois University, and they found the same thing. So it was it's been done in a couple different places, and it's kind of well known now that wheat residue can really help keep populations a little bit lower. That doesn't mean you can't have a problem with soybean cyst nematode, but it can kind of help manage some things as well.
So those, you know, those folks on the corn, wheat, soybean kind of rotation are doing probably the best that they can probably do. It's the problem is the folks at continuous beans, and we have several of those folks, especially in our geographical area we're in, McLean, Hopkins, Webster, that they don't raise a lot of wheat. They raise some, but not a lot. And and there are some people that are just doing continuous beans. And that, to me, is probably one of the worst things you can do, you know, when you need to try to break that up a little bit by raising a crop of corn every other year or so.
Absolutely. Those continuous beans keep me in business is what they do. That's not necessarily.
It makes lots of things worse, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, those are the fields where we're going to see problems first. I think before we got on the air here, we were talking a little bit about stem canker, southern stem canker. And some of the problems we had a few years ago with that disease, and where I saw that the worst were fields that had been continuous soybean for a few years in a row. And that's just a way for some of these pathogens to really build up, and even things that normally we would think might be minor, they can become severe because of those inoculum levels just increasing every year. And then, you know, eventually you get the weather that's going to be really favorable for that disease, and it can really do some damage. So. Definitely, crop rotation is very important.
You talked about the weather and environment and those types of things. Last year, we know that it wasn't, as far as corn, there wasn't a whole lot of diseases. Talk just a little bit about last year's soybean crop. Just a little review of kind of what you saw last year, and then, you know, thinking about moving forward, sort of the things that we need to be, you know, on the lookout for as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm based out of Princeton, not too far away from here, but so a lot of my work, a lot of my research is in Princeton at the research center there. And we actually had pretty good rainfall in Princeton, which is a little bit different than a lot of the state. So in my trials, I saw a lot of frog eye leaf spot. I had a lot of sudden death syndrome. We saw some Phytophthora root rot, so things that you might be, you know, normally with a little bit wetter weather, things that you might see. Now, as you kind of moved a little bit east in the state, they didn't have as much rainfall, but we still saw some things out there. Of course, you know, soybean cyst nematode, we've been continuing to kind of work with that, looking at seed treatments, and just from the samples, just kind of seeing where it's at. And you know, years that it's a little bit drier, where you don't get as much root development, that's when some of these things like soybean cyst nematode and maybe a few other root pathogens might play a bigger role in reducing disease, just because that you know, root development's not as much, and it's all kind of, all the pathogens might be right there and infecting and causing problems. So, but you know, lots of times the previous year doesn't really matter on what we see the next year. It can certainly, you know, you can drive up the amount of inoculum from having a bad year. You might have more inoculum, like of the frog eye leaf spot pathogen. There's probably going to be more residue that's got the pathogen within it, and but there's always going to be enough out there. Even if you didn't have it, the disease last year, that pathogen's probably still going to be there. And if you just have the right environment, and maybe if you got a variety that's a little bit on the susceptible side, you're still going to see those potential issues out there. So so that what happened last year is not a huge driver in what might happen the following year, unless you just had an absolute disaster in a field, and if you're thinking about going back in with soybeans, then that could be another disaster for sure.
Well, and again, just to repeat, you know, the importance of the sampling. I mean, that's just another reason there that we need to do that. And when we think about what it takes to put out a crop, just the input cost and I mean, you talk about your equipment cost, fuel cost, and then all the inputs. I mean, there's so much money that goes into producing your crop that's just another thing, you know, doing these samples that's not going to cost you anything.
To help. Think about that cost if you were having to pay for that yourself. If you were having a problem and you had to pay for that yourself, but, you know, you're not. You know, the Soybean Promotion Board is paying for that, and you know, it's a free service that, and I'll be honest with you, anymore, there's not a lot of free stuff that's worth having, but this is a very important program, and, you know, it's kind of one of those things, you know, when we talk about rain and not getting rain, or we are getting rain, soybeans, we've got diseases that are plentiful when it's raining, and then we've got some that are plentiful when it's not raining. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's one of those deals. The sampling is just another tool in the toolbox to help you from a management standpoint.
You know, and to add a little more value to that service, David, we all can remember as agents, because it's happened within our career, there was a time when our UK soil labs used to take those samples in and send them off to have them processed. And then there was a time when we didn't. So we actually had a span in time when you could not get that testing done in West Kentucky. And think about that, and think about the service that the Soybean Board's providing by doing that. And wasn't in that long ago, in the not-too-distant past, when it wasn't available to us at all. So
that's right. Well, Carl, what are some of the, maybe kind of the, well, obviously you're here to talk about one disease, but what, let's talk about the, you know, the red crown rot and you know, maybe some other things that we need to be looking out for.
Yeah, certainly. So red crown rot is a new disease to Kentucky. We found it for the first time in Graves County in 2021. Prior to that, it had kind of been known mostly as a disease of kind of the deep south, like Louisiana, Mississippi. It made a jump up into kind of our region. In 2017, it was found in western Illinois, kind of the, I don't know, if you look at the shape of Illinois, it kind of has a fat part in the middle, right? So the west part of that fat part, west of Springfield, if you know where that is. So that's where it was found. Just suddenly it was in western Illinois. We don't really know how it showed up there and kind of started to spread throughout Illinois. And so that kind of put it on my radar a little bit. It was in a neighboring state, and but actually, it was an agronomist that found it and sent me a perfect picture of it. So I don't really get the credit for finding it. It was found by somebody else, but then they alerted me. And, of course, we jumped on it and confirmed it and did all the tests we needed to confirm it. But, you know, it's likely been here for a while. And it looks, the foliar symptoms look just like what we see with sudden death syndrome. Southern stem canker also can cause these symptoms. So it's kind of what we call the interveinal chlorosis and necrosis of the leaves. So what happens with that is the main veins of the leaves, they're going to stay green. And in between those veins, it's going to turn chlorotic or yellow, and then that tissue is going to die or turn necrotic. And we won't really see that until later in the year, kind of after flowering, is when we tend to see those symptoms. But, you know, my thought is it's, and SDS is not uncommon in Kentucky, right? We can always, it doesn't matter the year, I can always find a little bit somewhere.
Sure.
And I think it probably just somebody just drive by and say, oh, there's a little bit of SDS over there, right? So this is another reason why we need to get out of our pickup trucks and and kind of look a little bit closer. But kind of the thing that makes it a little bit different is it causes a reddish discoloration on the roots and lower stem. Now, you can actually see that when the soybeans are still in the vegetative stages. It doesn't have to be past flowering. But there's not really going to be anything that's necessarily going to draw you to the mm-hmm. field until you see those foliar symptoms.
Yeah.
The real giveaway is that this fungus produces these structures called parathecia. And these are kind of spherical, kind of reddish-orange structures that are going to be on the lower stem and roots. If you see that, it's pretty much a giveaway that this is red crown rot, as long as you have those other symptoms present as well. The thing about those parathecia, those fungal structures, is they're not always there, and they can kind of wash off. They can kind of disappear over time. So you might see them, you know, in the field. You go in there one day, and you might come back the next week, and they might be gone. So even though it's really diagnostic, we don't always see those structures. So right now we know that we've confirmed it in Graves County. We've confirmed it in Callaway County last year. We know that it's in southern Indiana, just kind of across the river from Davis County, Kentucky. We know it's in Gallatin County, Illinois, just across the river from Union County, Kentucky. So
more than likely it's in our area. We just hadn't run up on it yet. Or very likely.
And so again, if you're seeing these kind of symptoms, especially if you've got, you know, a variety that you think, well, gosh, this was supposed to be resistant to SDS. Why am I seeing all this? It's important to try to get some samples in and, get them into your extension office, and then those will probably be sent to the plant disease diagnostic lab. And it's important for you to know what it is as a grower or a consultant or whoever's listening to this. But also it's important for people like me to know as well, so we can kind of document where it is and continue to work on it. But we're doing some trials, some field trials. Interestingly enough, because it's so limited in distribution here in Kentucky, some of our work has been in collaboration with the University of Illinois at a research farm in Western Illinois where the disease has been confirmed for a bit. So we've been able to look at some seed treatments, some planting dates, some things like that. And last year, we also had an on-farm seed treatment trial on a couple of producers in Graves County. So we're starting to work on it as best we can in Kentucky, just to try to get a little bit of a leg up on it. Hopefully, it doesn't get too bad, but we'd like to start learning about some management tools that we could incorporate if it does continue to spread, something that farmers might be able to do to manage the problem.
So talking about the spreading of it, we know where it's at. We know the places we've identified. And I think we could assume that we could fill in the gaps in between those places eventually. But how is it distributed? Being fungal borne, is it on weather patterns? Is it by the wind? What moves it around?
Yep, that's a great question. I'll tell you what we know, at least. and there's probably some things we don't know yet as well. But so it's a soil-borne fungus. It lives in the soil. It produces these structures called microsclerotia that kind of helps let it live longer than a couple of years, so it can, once it's there, it might kind of be there for a while. Really, as far as we know, any way that soil moves, soil particles move, that's how this can move. So oftentimes we think about equipment,
water,
anything that's going to move that soil. Migratory birds is another way. It's very similar to like soybean cyst nematode, how it spreads. That, believe it or not, there was some work done, gosh, I think in the 1970s or 80s, where they were looking at migratory birds and looking at their bird poop, basically, and finding soybean cyst nematode in that. So I think if you can imagine any way that soil moves, this fungus that causes red crown rot can definitely move along with it. So, yeah.
And in our part of the world, you know, that's kind of with Blackshank, that's one of those things that with the tobacco and tobacco production, you know, moving it from field to field. And I think that's something that producers are
aware of. About that. And you also think about the backwater that we have and a lot of our river bottoms.
It's the very reason I asked about Union County and counties in Illinois right across the river.
Right. That would, you know, I can think of a big part of McLean County that gets backwater that would really spread. Carl, do you think that the kind of the way to attack this thing or try to not attack it, but try to prevent it is going to be end up being some kind of seed treatment, or is it going to be something else?
Well, I think maybe initially there is one product that does have a label for it now. It's Saltro seed treatment. Syngenta owns that product. I think early last year, they had a 2EE label approved for certain states, which includes Kentucky and states around Kentucky. But that was for suppression of red crown rot. And we have seen that in our research trials that it does providing some suppression. It's not a silver bullet, but it can, I think it's maybe delaying infection.
Right.
Ultimately, I think it's going to be resistant varieties is probably going to be the best solution that we can have. But right now, that's just kind of a big black hole. We don't really know. Right. We probably have differences in susceptibility in the varieties that we grow. Mm-hmm. We probably don't have anything that's completely resistant, but likely there's enough genetic variability that we probably have some things that are more susceptible and some are less, but we just don't have that information.
Just going to take some time to identify that.
Yeah, I do know seed companies are considering this a serious issue, and they are starting breeding programs to look at this within their own germplasm and trying to develop lines that have resistance. So I think we'll get there. I mean, it just kind of reminds me of things like SDS back in the 1980s, right?
Yep.
I think it's just going to take some breeding efforts to kind of get to that point. Right now, we're just not quite there yet. We do have seed treatment. The other thing that we've noticed here in Kentucky, at least, is that our double crop fields seem to be the ones that are getting hit the most severely. So if you look at Graves County, where there's double crop and full season, we can find it in the full season soybeans, but it seems to be a little bit worse in our double crop fields. And I think a lot of it has to do with soil temperature. This fungus actually likes it a little bit warmer. I think I may not get this exactly right, but I think the temperature that it really likes is favorable is somewhere between like 76 and 86 degrees, kind of in that range. Yeah. So, you know, we were talking earlier about planting soybeans in early April. You know, you're not going to have, you're going to have the soil temperatures, but you might when you're planting double crop, right? So, that's another thing especially thinking about soil temperature and when you're planting your double crop soybeans, those would be ones that you definitely want to think about a little bit more. Or maybe, you know, if you're in this area where red crown rot is at, you might want to think about, for now, applying one of those seed that, well, right now there's only one seed treatment, but I'm assuming eventually we'll have some more products as well. Yeah.
I think there's a good, this is off the cuff here, but what percentage of soybeans that are planted are getting a seed treatment, do you think?
It's over half.
I was going to guess about half, but I didn't know.
Yeah, I think we're over 50% at this point in time. Not all of them are going to have a seed treatment that would be specific for things like sudden death syndrome.
Right.
So a lot of them are just going to have kind of a base treatment that's going to help out with things like Pythium, some of the Fusariums, some of the Rhizoctonia, but not necessarily for things like SDS or red crown rot. So those might have to be treatments that you would, you know, specify that you would want.
And for sure, you'd want to do that if you were in an area that has been identified, or even if you have a field that has been identified, for sure you need to be trying to do some of those things.
Yeah, I think for sure, if you are if your field has had red crown rot in the past, and when you go back to plant soybeans in that field, I think for now it would be probably in your best interest, especially if you're planting a little later. If you're planting really early, maybe not. But then you got to worry about SDS, right? So maybe not a bad idea. But yeah, for sure. I think if you're in those areas, or you know your neighbor has the problem and it's not quite to your field yet, as far as you know, you might want to think about it. Yeah.
Cool. You had mentioned the soybean or the diagnostic lab, and I just want to reiterate that, because so many diseases look alike. It is very difficult, even for a specialist like you. I've heard you say before, you know, at certain points, it's really difficult to be able to tell what that is just by looking at it in the field or in a picture or something like that. And so it's very important to get those samples in to the local extension office, and so that we can get those sent to the lab, regardless of the disease that we're talking about or the crop that we're talking about, to get those in so we can get the right identification on the disease, and for many reasons. But like you were talking about, knowing the history of your fields and being 100% confident that you know what that disease was, and not just think, well, I think it was sudden death, and then turns out it was, you know, it was red crown rot. I mean, that's just something you need to know.
Or something else.
That's correct. You know,
There's other diseases that share that same intravenous chlorosis as you were talking about. What are some of the other things that producers should be looking for that may help distinguish between it and SDS or any of the other diseases that share those same symptoms?
Yeah, so the top three that come to my mind for this area would be southern stem canker, sudden death syndrome, and red crown rot. There's another disease called brown stem rot, and as far as I know, we don't have that disease in Kentucky. I've heard people say that we do, but I've never run across it. That was a disease when I was at Illinois that I normally wouldn't see south of Interstate 80, and so that's pretty far north. So that usually likes a little cooler conditions. But so for sudden death syndrome, I mean, all of them are going to share those foliar symptoms like we talked about. For sudden death syndrome, one of the things you'd want to look at is dig up those roots. And sometimes it would just be the lack of seeing the reddish discoloration. Right. Sometimes you can see a bluish sporulation on the root. You won't always see that, but if you do, that's pretty diagnostic with sudden death syndrome. For stem canker, you're actually going to see symptoms on the stem as well. So not only would you see those foliar symptoms, you would see some lesions, lesions or cankers. So these would be kind of dark colored, kind of a black to maybe a reddish brown discoloration. Normally going to first start at the nodes of the soybean stem, and they're going to spread from there. So you kind of see both of those. And then, of course, with red crown rot, we kind of talked about that already, but the reddish discoloration of the lower stem and roots, maybe those parathecia if they show up. The other thing, the red crown rot fungus is a really good root rotter. It, out of all those, it's the one that's going to mess up those roots the most. So you might just kind of look at the roots themselves. Do they not look very healthy? Is that root system not very developed? That might be another thing that could help you with that a little bit as well.
Would the intravenous chlorosis kind of be the first warning sign of a lot of these different diseases, or where would a producer start as far as noticing? Is there anything they can scout for to see ahead of that chlorosis, or is that usually the first sign?
That's going to be the thing that's going to draw them to that field or that problem area for sure. With red crown rot, you can see that red discoloration before you see those foliar symptoms. But honestly, the only reason that I've seen that at that early of a stage is because I knew red crown rot was in that field before.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I never would have really just been looking. Right. And you gotta get down on your hands and knees to see those things as well. And so you're probably not going to see that unless you just get real lucky, or you know, you just want to go out and start looking. So certainly those foliar symptoms, that intravenous chlorosis, that's what's going to draw you to those areas, and then, you know, kind of make you want to look at those other things we talked about, or grab some samples and get those sent off to the diagnostic lab to kind of confirm what it might be.
When we talk about treatments and things of diseases and using our fungicides, you know, we always have a concern of resistance, because we've seen that in herbicides, and when you get in that situation, you want to try not to get in that situation. So talk a little bit about just good tips for fungicide use, because I think that is something that we don't talk about. We do talk about it, but it you can't talk about it enough to really try to fight that resistance with those.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important thing. I mean, we kind of have a limited number of active ingredients from different chemistry classes that are used for some of our foliar fungicides. And it's not like they're coming up with a new one every year. Mm-hmm. These things take almost generational to get some new chemistry classes. So it takes a long time. So we already are dealing with this problem. If you remember, one of those chemistry classes that we have are known as the strobilurin fungicides. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're called the QOIs. It's the same thing. They're just sometimes, depending on the group mm-hmm. you're talking to, their terminology is different. So this was kind of that first group of fungicides that we really started using on soybeans in the mid-2000s. Things like Quadris and Headline, if you mm-hmm. kind of remember those products.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we got some triazole, different chemistry class triazoles that were started to be used in soybeans. And then soybean rust actually was one of the things that kind of brought mm-hmm. those along, even though it's never been a problem really here in Kentucky and in northern states. But that did spur the registration of some of those mm-hmm. products. And then more recently, we have some of the SDHI active ingredients. Those are kind of the main three. We also have Topsin, or the generic versions of Topsin. That's a different chemistry class, but we don't see a whole lot of that used in soybean. So we're really just kind of dealing with three. And the strobilurins, we've got four different fungi that cause foliar diseases in our state that are now resistant to the strobilurin fungicide. So these are the ones that cause frog eye leaf spot, Septoria brown spot, Cercospora leaf spot, and target spot. We've confirmed that we have strains of each of those different fungi that cause those diseases that are resistant to the strobilurin fungicide. So those aren't really that effective anymore. So now mm-hmm. we've just got the triazoles and the SDHIs. So, you know, one of the things that we can do to kind of help preserve that chemistry that we have is to really only use these products when we need them. So, mm-hmm. you know, we don't need them every year. We don't need them in every field. We've got research showing this that, overall, if you took all of my data from Kentucky, and I used to be at Illinois, you could throw it in as well because it looks the same. If you look at the average yield response from across all my stuff with soybean fungicides, it's probably going to be somewhere around a bushel and a half to 2 bushels an acre. That's the average, okay? All right, some years, maybe depending on the price of the product and the marketing price of the soybean, okay, that maybe. But that's an average, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that sometimes it was not that high, sometimes it was higher. So me personally, I would rather look at, okay, what are the ones on the right side of that graph, if you're picturing it in your head,
mm-hmm.
that ones that are going to be higher mm-hmm. than that 1.5 to 2 bushels an acre. And those are the ones where we actually had disease problems, things like frog eye leaf spot. And so a lot of that comes down to variety. If you've got varieties that maybe are really good yielders, but they don't have very good resistance to frog eye leaf spot, and you've got the weather that would be conducive. So that means, warm weather, lots of heavy dew,
mm-hmm.
Rainfall in June and July to go along with that. Those are the times when you might consider spraying a fungicide. And when you do spray, that's also the time when you need to be sure you're using a product that contains multiple active ingredients and multiple active ingredients that still work. So that doesn't mean a strobilurin and a triazole.
Right.
That means, maybe a triazole and an SDHI product, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it can still have the strobe in it, but it needs to have at least two other active ingredients that still have effectiveness. Otherwise, if you're spraying something that has a strobilurin and a triazole, the triazole is the one that's doing all the heavy lifting there because there's resistance already to the strobe. And so what you're doing is you're just causing the selection pressure, and eventually you're selecting out some of those individuals in that fungal pathogen population that are going to be less sensitive or resistant to the triazoles. And so this is some work that we're doing in our research lab at Princeton, and we've got some data kind of showing that, kind of sort of circumstantial evidence, but showing that fungicides, these triazoles, maybe aren't working as well as they used to over time. We've got about 10 years of data where we can look at the efficacy, and we see over time that the control is kind of reducing. So yeah, we know that's probably on the horizon. So we just have to try to do things to preserve that, those chemistry classes as long as we can. Growing resistant varieties is another way to do it. Yeah. We see that when we grow resistant varieties, you don't always need to spray a fungicide. So, yeah.
Well, it's a pretty good management lesson. I don't know if anybody was paying attention to
absolutely
that.
Absolutely.
But it really was. And you know how important it is for those management decisions. Yes. And they can come back and bite us. But then I think Carl just gave you a really good lesson about how to make a really good management decision.
Absolutely. And because we know there's most every soybean acre is sprayed with a fungicide now. And it's just part of the, at the beginning of the year, there are, you know, most producers are planning on that. And but it, when we're talking about, you know, resistance, that's not helping that. It's hurting it.
Yeah. You know, yeah, we always talk in the past about coming up with ideas for future shows while we're doing one. And we spent a lot of time today talking about soybean diseases. I think we're going to need to do a follow-up show probably this spring or early summer, just on fungicide applications, yeah, and how to be effective with those, whether, yeah, starting with the selection of the product, the correct product or the most effective product to meet your needs. Then I think we can go into nozzle selection and gallons per acre of water and coverage and all that, mm-hmm, too, and probably make a whole show out of it.
Yeah, yeah, the do's sounds, and don'ts.
Hey, I like that's that, right, the do's and don'ts. Well, you know, we always try to wrap things up with a timely tip towards the end of this show, and because of what we were talking about and the kind of direction we knew we would go in with a lot of different diseases, we thought that a good timely tip would be to, for producers to take the time to familiarize yourself with all stages of the different disease cycles that you may encounter. You know, if you just stopped at, like you said, that windshield tour that saw some chlorotic leaves, you might call it one thing and may be right, may not be right, but be able to get out and tell apart some of these different stages of different diseases. That will, to me, is the beginning stage of making some of those management decisions that you may need to choose. So anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's a great idea. You got to know what you have, right? And yep, and know what you might encounter. So I think, you know, we've got some good resources. I'll put a plug in for the Crop Protection Network. That's a good place to go for a lot of multi-state extension publications, a lot of, mm-hmm, focus on diseases of corn, soybean, and wheat. We have a new publication with UK on red crown rot, and you can just probably just Google red crown rot Kentucky, and that's gonna get you there.
Yep. I've actually got it pulled up here. Vicky printed it out for us from the beginning. That's PPFS-AG-S-25. That's plant pathology fact sheet. So it's a good one. Something I'll give a plug to also is our the Kentucky Pest News newsletter. There was one I looked out to prepare for this that actually was August of last year, and it made a comparison of all those different diseases that share some of those same foliar symptoms. So it's something that folks can subscribe to and
lots of, right lots in of their great email. Yeah, lots of great information out there. Just we'll be glad to help you out, too, the Extension Office. Anybody that needs any help with that, we'll be glad to help them out.
Absolutely. Well, Carl, we appreciate you being here with us today. We want to thank you for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.